From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The challenge of the 21st century will be to equalize the playing field in the criminal justice system. Racism is still alive and well in the criminal justice system across America.
Today, a conversation with the Reverend Al Sharpton on police brutality, Hillary Clinton, and the war against the homeless. Also, the latest on the Los Angeles Police Department scandal and the corruption probe that's led to the investigation over 3,000 criminal convictions. We'll speak with one of the lead reporters on the story, as well as the mother of its only murder victim and a former LAPD officer whose brother was killed by the police. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Hisashi Auchi died yesterday. He is the worker exposed to a massive dose of radiation on September 30th during Japan's worst nuclear accident. His death has fueled calls today for a slowdown in Japan's atomic energy program. About 60 protesters gathered at the Peace Memorial Park in Hiroshima, the site of the 1945 atomic bomb attack, to urge the government to abandon its development of nuclear power. Greenpeace Japan urged Japan today to cancel a program to develop reactors that produce plutonium. Canada yesterday launched a $1 billion lawsuit against R.J. Reynolds and affiliates, alleging that tobacco companies defrauded the government by conspiring to smuggle cigarettes from the United States to avoid high Canadian taxes in the early 1990s. The government alleges that cigarettes manufactured by R.J. Reynolds' Canadian affiliate were exported to the U.S. and funneled into the hands of a small group of distributors. Those agents allegedly then sold the tobacco to Native Indians on a reservation straddling the border, from which the goods made their way onto the black market in Canada. The scheme seriously undermined the government's efforts to stop youths from smoking, according to Canada's federal health minister. The large scale of the operation and the popularity of cheaper black market cigarettes forced the federal government to reduce tobacco taxes in early 1994. The suit also alleges that R.J. Reynolds, working with the Industry Council in Canada, said it was the Russian mob that was smuggling in the cigarettes and that they were trying to curb the smuggling. This news from the Washington Post: an experiment beginning early next year in the Washington area may one day make it possible to predict traffic jams an hour in advance. The Washington Post says the experiment will involve tracking cell phone use by people driving on a stretch of the beltway circling Washington. Cell phone calls are handed off from tower to tower. By following the energy pattern of an individual call, computers can calculate how fast the car is going. Traffic officials emphasize they will not be able to hear what people are saying or identify who a caller is, but information from a number of calls could tell them reams about traffic in a particular area. In a landmark move that could affect labor fights across the country, residents and interns at a private Boston hospital yesterday voted overwhelmingly to be represented by a federally protected union. The hospital had already recognized interns as union members, that's Boston Medical Center. However, they did not have the protection of federal labor law before Tuesday's vote. It was made possible after a groundbreaking ruling from the National Labor Relations Board. Three undocumented immigrants have filed discrimination charges in Chicago against a supervisor at a plastics plant, giving the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission a test case for its new policy toward undocumented workers. Until recently, the EEOC would not defend undocumented workers, but in October, EEOC Chair Ida Castro amended a long-standing policy and said the federal agency would come to the aid of undocumented workers if they were discriminated against on the job. This news from Chechnya. Chechen fighters claimed today to have encircled and inflicted heavy losses on a force of Russian paratroopers who parachuted into the southern mountains to cut off rebel supply lines. Meanwhile, federal forces stepped up their artillery barrage today on the Chechen capital Grozny, the last major town occupied by the rebels in the breakaway republic. The Indonesian president says the country will not allow its top generals to be tried in an international war crimes tribunal now being considered by the United Nations. Indonesian President Wahid made the comment just hours after Indonesia's former military chief, General Wiranto, now a senior cabinet minister, failed to appear before an Indonesian government-appointed panel investigating human rights abuses in East Timor. Meanwhile, the leaders of two pro-Indonesian military gangs in East Timor also ignored summons to appear. And this news from West Timor, at least seven people were hurt in a grenade attack by a suspected pro-Jakarta militiaman at a market in Kupang. And finally, Sri Lanka's president was sworn into a second term in office today after a narrow election victory that has been called into question, reflecting voter discontent with her failure to end the war with Tamil separatists. Chandrika Kumaratunga was sworn in as her wounded right eye was bandaged from an assassination attempt against her on Saturday. That's some of the news.
Manganani, Manganani.
Good morning.
Good morning. Manganani. Yeah, Africa, Africa. Here comes the children. Manganani, Africa. Here comes the children. Eba, Eba, Eba.
And that's the music of Heritage OP, who is actually joining us in the studio today with that music, and we'll be playing our breaks. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And a very interesting article in yesterday's New York Times, buried in the business section, of course, is that Monsanto is having all kinds of problems with this newly announced merger with Pharmacia Upjohn. Apparently, Wall Street doesn't look with favor on Monsanto because they're still not completely separating off their agricultural unit. As you know, Monsanto has been labeled as a producer of Frankenstein foods in Europe because of its genetically modified seeds. But the Monsanto executives have consistently said that this plant biotechnology will produce enormous profits in the future. And having spent billions of dollars to develop genetically engineered crops, they continue to lobby for worldwide approval. Just to give you an example, in 1996, there were only 2.8 million acres worldwide planted with these genetically modified seeds. This year, there are 70 million acres worldwide, an explosion in just a few years. And Monsanto, of course, is producing 90% of all the genetically modified seeds in the world.
That's an interesting contrast to a piece in yesterday's Wall Street Journal, Juan, that was a kind of profile of Robert Shapiro, the CEO of Monsanto, which talked about how much more of a, I think, a puff piece, which talked about how he is finally coming to realize the level of opposition against genetically altered foods, something that apparently they had not taken into consideration as they built their company, a mere chemical company, into a life sciences corporation. Certainly, I'm sure Seattle did not help. And speaking of Seattle, folks, tune in on Friday on Democracy Now! When we're going to be bringing you a full hour on the sounds of Seattle as we look back over the last few weeks to this true millennial battle that shaped up with in the lead, young people from around the world taking on the countries of the world as they tried to break down trade barriers, saying that they threatened public health and the environment. But right now we're going to turn to another issue and a sharp rebuke to the administration of New York. Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, federal officials, have decided to bypass city agencies and handing out millions of dollars in government money to those who help the homeless. The mayor said the change was motivated by politics. Housing Secretary Andrew Cuomo said the change is necessary following a federal court ruling that found city officials demonstrated a pattern of antagonism and acted with retaliatory intent against a nonprofit homeless provider provider that had criticized the mayor. The provider eventually lost $2.5 million in federal funds. The change means that the Department of Housing and Urban Development will distribute federal money directly to those helping homeless people rather than using the city as a middleman. Well, we're joined right now by the Reverend Al Sharpton. He actually is headed off to court after he leaves Democracy Now! Because he is one of those who was arrested recently protesting the mayor's policy around the homeless, protesting the fact that the mayor has been increasing arrests of the homeless. We're also going to be speaking to him about police brutality cases, including the Giallo case, which has just been moved to Albany. That's the case of the Ghanaian immigrant who last year was killed by four New York City police officers in a hail of 41 bullets. And we'll speak to him about the Abner Louima sentencing as well. That is the sentencing of a police officer in the Abner Louima case, the Haitian immigrant who was brutalized by New York City police officers. After that, we'll be talking about the LAPD. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend Al Sharpton, President of the National Action Network.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, why don't we start with this issue of housing and the homeless and Mayor Giuliani's crackdown on homeless people, arresting more than 100 people in the last weeks.
Well, I think it's a very ruthless policy, but it's consistent with this the tenure of this mayor in office. He has repeatedly used poor people and people of color as his way of campaigning. The irony of his accusing HUD Secretary Cuomo of playing politics is that he is playing politics in this so-called cleanup of the homeless, which is really a war on the homeless. People around the country need know that what, in my judgment, the mayor's doing is he's trying to impress upstate voters and suburban voters that he has cleaned up New York. There was a vicious, unjustifiable attack on a young woman with a brick several weeks ago in New York. And to reinforce his image that these things do not happen anymore in New York, he immediately went out and declared war on the homeless because his image was at stake around the country, around the state where he wants to run for United States Senate. And he accused the homeless of being the perpetrators of the crime. This is where this homeless policy came from. In fact, when the man that is accused was arrested, he was not a homeless man. He lives with his girlfriend and did not stay in homeless shelters. But doesn't matter. For political reasons, we have all of the homeless now being stereotyped as people that unjustifiably and viciously assault innocent people in the street with bricks. Therefore, they must be swept off the streets. At the same time, they had just announced the week before that if you were in the shelters and were not working in WEP programs, which is programs in the city that you work for your welfare check, that you'd be thrown out. So that is why we went to City Hall Park to hold a tent city. We tried to build a tent city reminiscent of the Resurrection City proposed by Dr. Martin Luther King 31 years ago. And the reason we went to City Hall Park, Amy and Juan, is because the mayor just spent $28 million renovating the park, building new fountains and new gadgets, at a time that he has not put any kind of money near that amount into programs for affordable housing and the programs for the mentally ill and others, and at the same time has penalized programs like Housing Works, which is the program the Secretary HUD referred to yesterday, because they had the audacity to question his political career as well as his policy as it comes to homelessness.
Well, Reverend, the unprecedented rebellion by all of these nonprofit agencies saying that they are just not going to adhere to the dictates of the mayor, and then, of course, his threat to cut them off have brought federal intervention. And while the mayor can claim politics, there's no doubt that Andrew Cuomo has already established a reputation on the issue of homelessness long before he went into political office.
Exactly.
So that it seems to me that at least on this issue, I mean, if Cuomo had been involved on some other issue, but you can understand why he himself would be outraged by the mayor's attempt to, as the secretary said, criminalize the homeless.
And I think that it would have been irresponsible for Cuomo not to, and many New Yorkers know I'm not a fan of the Cuomos, but I think in this regard he acted responsibly, and I think he's protecting the citizens, and I salute him in this regard for what he did. It reminds me of the civil rights days when we had to, in the South, appeal to the federal government to protect the people against local municipalities and local states and local sheriffs. What Cuomo has done is protect the homeless against a hostile mayor who wants to use them as gun fodder for his Senate campaign.
Well, going from New York City to New York State and national politics, at the same time that this was announced yesterday, Andrew Cuomo announcing that HUD would be taking away the authority to dispense money in New York City for those most in need, Hillary Clinton was also in town at a major fundraiser. She will be running, we believe, against Rudolph Giuliani. And this is the politics that Mayor Giuliani was talking about when he said that this was a political hit on him. You're a major player in this political scene, Reverend Sharpton. You'll be meeting with Hillary Clinton, is that right?
Yes.
Well, this is a major development because she has not met with you before.
Well, I think it is major only to her detractors and mine. I ran for the U.S. Senate. I'm the only African-American that ran for the seat she's running for. So in any other world, minus a Giuliani, it would be expected that she's going to meet with me. I did very well in running. There's nothing extraordinary about that. Senator Schumer has been to our headquarters several times. Mr. Spitzer. What the right wingers, who's the Attorney General of the state of New York, the right wingers are trying to spin that if you go to people like Sharpton who are active and to the left or whatever, it will cost you. What I've challenged them is to show me one election where people have come to us that they suffered. Charles Schumer, who is the present senator of the state, when he was running, made three appearances at our headquarters. He won. Elliot Spitzer won for state attorney general, did the same thing. Bill Bradley, who's running for president now, came and spoke at our headquarters. He went up in the polls. This is a myth that you're going to get a backlash, but if they can intimidate you, you may get a backlash from the people that do relate to us for not coming. I think that what responsible journalists must do is say, okay, fine. If Sharpton is so controversial, show me the election that someone that did deal with him suffered as a result of. I remember when I ran for mayor in New York City in 97, they said, oh, don't even worry about it, to my opponent, Ruth Messenger. The white backlash will kill him. Whites will not stand for Al Sharpton to be mayor. We almost had the first runoff in 20 years in New York. In fact, I did better than any other black candidate for mayor in the history of this city other than Dave Dinkins, who won. So I think that what they really are trying to do is not about me personally. They're trying to marginalize a whole progressive way of thinking. And with Giuliani's spin doctors, they're able to create this myth that you have to stay away from your base. And they used to do it. The reason I know it's not personal, they used to do it to Jesse Jackson. I mean, Juan knows this. They've done it to anyone that does the things I do because they want to really keep you and your constituency out of addressing mainstream political questions. That's the agenda.
Reverend, one other question, of course, that's seized public attention here in the city in the past week was the Amadou Diallo decision of the appellate division of the Supreme Court to move the whole case of the police shooting of this African immigrant to Albany, 150 miles away, to a county that is 88% white, and move it out of the Bronx, a county that is about 80% black and Hispanic. What is your analysis or viewpoint of how this came about and what how people can respond to this decision?
I think it is an absolute insult to the people of the city. The appellate court in their ruling said that because of publicity and because of protests, they could not get a fair trial. People around the country need to know, first of all, the defense attorneys were not talking about getting a jury. Even if I would assume that they couldn't get a fair jury, which I think is absolutely repugnant. We've had cases from the World Trade bombers to Colin Ferguson to other cases that were much more biased in terms of coverage because in this particular case, you've had our demonstrations. You've had the police demonstrations. You've had New Yorker magazine that did the cover of 41 bullets. You had New York magazine that did a sympathetic piece on the cops. So there has not been a one-way ticket here. Even when we had the now very well-known civil disobedience actions for 13 days at one police plaza, every day there was a counter demonstration by police. police there. Both were covered. I mean, a guy stood out there 13 days with a sign saying Al Sharpton and company go to hell. He was on the news every night.
Reverend Sharpton, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we're going to break with a musical group that is joining us in the studio, Heritage OP. When we come back, we'll continue with Reverend Sharpton on the Giallo protests as well as other issues of police brutality, and then we'll move to Los Angeles to talk about the latest scandal there in the Ramparts division of the LAPD. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is the Reverend Al Sharpton, who is president of the National Action Network, a major player in New York politics, as well as on the national stage, particularly known as he takes the crusade against police brutality around the country. Yesterday, he was in Lower Manhattan in front of a federal courthouse, standing with hundreds of other people, demanding an end to judicial apartheid as people protested the moving of the Amadou Diallo murder trial to Albany, an overwhelmingly white city, the capital of New York. Reverend Sharpton, one of the reasons cited in the appellate court decision was the amount of protests that had taken place in New York City. Do you think that this is a very serious issue? Suggestion that if you don't protest, this kind of action wouldn't be taken, will put a damper on protest.
I think the attempt was to chill protest, which is why it was important hundreds would come out yesterday to let them know we will not be chilled. And I was glad that we got the reaction we did, that people came out. I mean, to think about an appellate court in a so-called democracy saying that you can be too democratic, I mean, that it's too much for you to speak your opinion, it's absurd. And never talk about the police that marched on their side. I can remember when 10,000 police marched on the Bronx courthouse, the same one they took this case from, for Sullivan, the killer of Eleanor Bumpus. So, I mean, by what precedent now do you limit protest? Police are allowed to protest, but people that question these police, not even the entire department, don't have the right to protest. That is why it's important that if this case does go to Albany, and we're trying to get the federal government to stop it, but if it does go, we will be there to protest. They cannot feel that they can stifle or intimidate people from standing up for their rights. You're talking about an unarmed man going in his own home, shot at 41 times. He wouldn't have faced that in a firing squad. And they want to know why there's outrage to that. They want to act like that's normal. It would have been abnormal for people not to come out with such an inhuman act.
You've compared this to Simi Valley.
Well, it's the Simi Valley strategy. Put it out in the suburbs, clean the cops up. Which is why we're saying to the federal government, as we did with Louima, by the way, we marched and got the federal government to come into the Abner Louima case, the case people around the country remember of the man sodomizing a police precinct. Once the feds started, then the local DA deferred to the feds, and Mr. Volpe, who was the one that stuck the plunger in Abner Louima's rectum, is in a federal penitentiary today. This is what we'd like to see the feds do here. Not even overruling the appellate if there's no standing. They can say a man has the right, the civil right, to go to his home at night. And anyone that conspires to stop him from doing that has violated his civil rights, which gives them federal authority to prosecute them on civil rights charges with life in jail as the penalty.
Well, Reverend, one of the points that I tried to make in a column yesterday in the Daily News was that the judge in this case, assigned to the case, was an African-American judge. But because she is only an acting Supreme Court judge and not a fully elected Supreme Court judge, she could not move with the case upstate as any other judge would have been able to. So that this was when the appellate division made this ruling, they knew that this judge was going to be removed from the case. Now, I'm getting ready to do a series right after the new year on how precisely the court system in New York City has been taken over by political forces and right-wing forces, and how basically the people of New York City are being denied the right to select their judges. What's your viewpoint of this whole situation with how the courts are functioning, especially the local courts here in New York?
Now, I think what you wrote yesterday was brilliant, and I think that what people need to understand is that the petitioners, the police, the defense attorneys, they themselves asked to have it moved to Westchester. The appellate court sent it to Albany, where there are no blacks or women that could even be the judge in this case. Isn't it unusual, if you're going to grant a motion, that you even give a worse venue than the people that asked that requested the motion in the first place? So there isn't even an opportunity for a black or a woman to sit on this. Because I think, again, I want to remind people around the country, these attorneys were not looking for a jury trial. They wanted a bench trial. And a bench trial is where the judge makes a decision, not a jury. They could not trust these policemen's fate in the hands of a black woman. And clearly the appellate court, doing them a favor, said even in Westchester they may get a black or a woman or someone progressive. Let's put it all the way up to Albany. And I think that that is obvious. And I think that it is reflective of the politics that is played in the whole judicial court level now in the city, where now the political powers that be cart their favors with judges, with decisions that really disenfranchises the people. And I have nothing against the people in Albany, by the way. I just think it's a question of disenfranchisement and a manipulation of the judicial process using the race card to try and deny Amadou Diallo his civil rights. The people in Albany are not bad people. It's the process that has been tainted by this outright contract, as far as I'm concerned.
A quick comment on the Avner Louima case and the sentencing in the last few weeks of Justin Volpe to 30 years in prison. This is the police officer who actually did the attack on Avner Louima.
Correct. And that, by the way, and both of you are well aware of it, had tremendous publicity, tremendous protest. That's why the feds got it. So we did nothing different in this case than we've done down through the years. I must say also, particularly Amy and Juan, isn't it ironic that this man's getting ready to celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday next month, and he's against people doing what Dr. King did? I mean, I want to know how he's going to stand up at a King Day celebration and salute a man who made history because he led protests and things after he has spent all of his time trying to stifle that type of activity.
The anti-police brutality movement is growing around the country.
Absolutely.
There's no question about that. You recently were on a tour with Amadou Diallo's mother and father around the country, talking about the issue from California to Chicago, et cetera. We also are seeing the presidential campaign shape up for the year 2000. Do you think they're going to converge? I mean, are the presidential candidates like Vice President Al Gore, Bill Bradley, who makes embrace a major issue, they're going to have to really take on this issue? And what would that mean?
Well, that's one of the reasons we had Bradley uptown. That's why we're going to have Gore. We must challenge every presidential candidate to tell us how you would deal with the problem of police misconduct, police brutality. It's a major issue. And that's why they want to try and marginalize those of us that would raise it as a major issue. When Bill Clinton came in 1992, it was in the wake of the Rodney King case. He said, we're going to deal with police brutality. He did not. We cannot afford to let another president go in and not deal with this issue head on.
What would dealing with it look like?
Excuse me?
What would dealing with police brutality look like?
They could say that I will appoint an attorney general that will put together a special component in the Justice Department to deal at a federal level with police misconduct and to protect the rights of citizens against police, particularly since around the country, local district attorneys who depend on police unions to get elected seem to not be able to handle the prosecution of police.
And you would think that by all the cases we've had in recent years, New Orleans, the Philadelphia situation,
Pittsburgh.
The Los Angeles situation, Pittsburgh, that somebody would say, hey, there's a systemic problem here in a lot of big city, especially big city police forces, in terms of what is occurring in minority communities.
And the only way that will happen is we must stand up and demand it of the candidates. Can anyone in their right mind in New York, in the wake of Louima and Diallo, vote for somebody and they don't know their policy on police? Can anyone in California in the wake of Taisha Miller do the same? It is a national outrage, and it's a national pattern. It ought to be in the presidential debate.
You had an interaction, didn't you, with President Clinton along with Amadou Diallo's mother?
Yes.
What was that scene in Washington?
Well,
and what did you tell him?
Well, Janet Reno had convened 200 law enforcement people and activists to talk about the problem. Clinton came. And I invited Mrs. Diallo. I brought her with me. And I said to him that you never kept your commitment after Rodney King and that your whole historic trip to Africa was undercut with 41 shots of an African young man in the Bronx. What is your Department of Justice going to do about it? And I had a meet with Mrs. Diallo. He said we would look into it. Now's the time for him to look into it, that we've been sent north 150 miles with the Simi Valley strategy. If there ever was a time that Bill Clinton's Justice Department needs to look into something, it's now.
Well, Reverend Sharpton, I want to thank you very much for being with us, President of the National Action Network, as he heads off to court today to deal with an arrest. He was arrested last week for protesting the policy of arresting the homeless in New York City.
Thank you.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute, we're going to go to Los Angeles, not far from Simi Valley, to talk about the latest corruption scandal there in the Los Angeles Police Department. But Juan, before we do, we have a request of our listeners. We'd like you to join us in the listener sentry, folks around the country. We're going to put together a program for December 30th. A year-end show, which is a listener's century, your view of the most important issues, events, and people of the 20th century. We've already had people to start to call into our comment line. We ask you to do the same. This is what one of our listeners had to say, just a preview of what our show will sound like on December 30th.
Sandra Drake, I live in Menlo Park, California, and I listen to KPFA Pacifica Berkeley. Here are my 10 major events: discovering the structure of DNA, the emergence of the animal rights movement, the genetic alteration of food crops, advances in space exploration, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the end of European colonialism as established after 1492, the globalization of capitalism and the emergence of the people's movement contesting it at the Battle of Seattle, the development of the computer, the huge rate of species extinction, and the rooting of Buddhism in Western culture. Thank you.
And we'd like to hear what your thoughts are. Give us a call. This is a full show that will be our listeners talking about the century. You can even go so far as the millennium. Give us a call at 212-209-2999. And make your comments on our comment line. That's 212-209-2999. And Juan, speaking of looking back, I was just talking to someone who had come upon the Avedon book of the 60s. I didn't know that Richard Avedon had taken a picture of you.
Actually, Amy, he's taken quite a few of me and several other members
in
the leadership of the Young Lords back in, I guess, 1969 or may have been even early 1970. Yes, I've seen the book. He sent me a copy a couple of weeks ago before it was published.
Well, I think we're wasting you on radio, Juan. You clearly, we've got to cast your image all over this country. But folks, we're looking forward to what you have to say about the century, Juan, and all of our listeners as we move now to the issue of police corruption in Los Angeles. The latest corruption scandal in the LAPD at the Rampart Division has mushroomed to involve the investigation of more than 3,000 cases, vastly more than previously reported. The Public Defender's Office will have to review more than 800 potentially tainted cases involving former LAPD officer Rafael Perez, who has been convicted of cocaine theft and is assisting authorities under a grant of immunity, and 2,500 more involving other officers from the Rampart Crash anti-gang unit who've either been fired or are under investigation. And yesterday, the sentencing of Officer Perez was delayed until February 25th while authorities seek corroboration of allegations he made about fellow officers. He has a plea bargain guaranteeing him a 5-year sentence for theft in return for his cooperation in the investigation. He's offered information about other officers, linking them to lies, thefts, planting evidence in a shooting that paralyzed a man and put him in prison. As a result of the Rampart's probe, so far 4 people have been released from prison and 7 convictions overturned. We're joined by a number of people today to talk about this issue, including the mother of the only murder victim associated with the Rampart scandal. We'll also be joined by a former Los Angeles police officer whose brother was killed by the LA police. But first, for an overview, we turn to Matt Late, who is the police reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He and another reporter broke the Rampart story in September. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Matt Late.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you with us. Why don't you lay out for us the scope of the issue?
Well, the scope of it has surprised many in the LAPD and the community of Los Angeles. It started with the cocaine trial of Rafael Perez, who was on trial for stealing about 8 pounds of cocaine from LAPD evidence lockers. Facing a conviction in that case, on the eve of his trial, he worked out an arrangement with prosecutors to turn on other allegedly bad officers and talk about a number of police crimes and misconduct. I know for a fact that the detectives who were investigating Perez had no idea of the scope about what he was going to talk about. I mean, to date, he has disclosed a number of things, from bad shootings, evidence planting, false arrests, witness intimidation, beatings, theft, drug dealing, and perjury. And that's just among the issues that are being looked at. The department, in addition to its criminal probe, has a parallel internal probe looking at some of the systemic issues within the department to determine what needs to be done and what should be recommended to prevent something like this from happening in the future. The criminal probe right now is focusing at, or has resulted in the suspension of at least a dozen officers. And our understanding is that it could involve many more by the time it's over.
Well, Matt, from the sounds of it, this is almost like something right out of that film L.A. Confidential in terms of the depth of the problem here. But now, is there any indication that this problem went beyond the Ramparts division?
Yeah, there is some indication of that. They are looking into other areas as well as other officers who are not associated with Perez. I mean, they're looking at cases that he has not even discussed as part of their investigation. They've stumbled on other things. Some of the most troubling things that have come out as a result of this is that defendants who have been arrested under false pretenses and planted evidence and bogus testimony actually didn't fight these charges in court, but rather took plea deals because they were facing such stiff sentences if they were convicted. And the belief by their attorneys and by them themselves was that a jury would not believe them versus a police officer. Many of these people that have been victimized, allegedly victimized in these situations, are gang members, drug dealers, and other members of society that feel they wouldn't get an impartial jury.
Matt Lay, can you explain what the anti-gang unit CRASH stands for?
The name of it is CRASH, and it stands for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. I do know that the internal probe at the LAPD, one of the recommendations is that they're going to change the name The crash units, they're in each of the 18 LAPD divisions throughout the city. Those units were comprised to be elite officers who cracked down on gang problems. And by the looks of it in Rampart, many people believe that they kind of adopted some of the practices of the gangs that they were charged with policing.
How many innocent people do you think are currently in jail as a result of the false testimony of the LAPD?
Boy, that's a really tough question to answer. Like you said earlier, there are some 3,000 cases that are going to be under review. Just because they're under review doesn't mean that they're all tainted with bad evidence and testimony. It just means that they involve at least one or perhaps more of the officers that have been identified or suspended as a result of the probe. We do know that four men have been released from custody, that other cases, other men who have been have served their time or are in prison on other terms have had their convictions wiped out. We heard from our district attorney, Gil Garcetti, that he thinks that there could be as many as 40 other cases like this, habeas writs, that would seek to get people out of custody. But then it's unknown what will happen when they review all the cases.
Well, Matt Lade, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who, along with Scott Glover, has been doing a series of pieces on the Ramparts Division and the growing police corruption scandal there. When we come back from our break, we're going to speak with the mother and attorney of a man who was killed by police officers. L.A. prosecutors now asking a judge to overturn the conviction of another man who was involved in that case as a result of perhaps tainted testimony of police officers. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Stay with us. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and again, the music during our breaks being brought to us live in our studio by Heritage OP. We're talking about Los Angeles police corruption. Los Angeles prosecutors have asked a judge to overturn the conviction of a gang member accused of assaulting police during a controversial 1996 shooting in which the LAPD officers from the scandal-plagued Rampart Division killed one man and wounded two others. The court action is significant because it suggests that prosecutors no longer have confidence in the accounts of officers who were involved in the shooting, characterized by former officer turned informer Rafael Perez as dirty. It's potentially the most serious case under review in the expanding LAPD corruption scandal, in that a homicide occurred during an incident involving alleged police misconduct. The man who was killed is named Jose Manuel Saldana. We're joined by his mother, as well as the attorney for the family, Antonio Rodriguez, a civil rights attorney for 15 years, who also is a member of Police Watch. He represents the family of the Saldanas, as well as another person who may well be a Rampart victim. Antonio Rodriguez, can you describe the case of what happened to Mr. Jose Manuel Saldana?
It's actually Juan Manuel Saldana. Well, Juan Manuel was actually shot and killed when he was unarmed. in an apartment building that police officers from Crash in Ramparts were raiding on a night after a shooting had taken place in the same area the day before. And what they did afterwards attempted to justify the shooting by claiming that Juan Manuel Saldaña was running around aiming guns at police officers and that they shot him on several occasions. One of the disturbing elements of this case is that not only did the officers that did the shooting file false police reports after planting a gun on Juan Manuel Saldaña, but one of the things that is really disturbing is that the police chief at the time, Willie Williams, actually signed off on a report which was patently false, and it is easy to see that it is patently false when one compares the physical evidence, which is the autopsy reports, which say that Juan Manuel Saldaña was shot from the top, from someone standing above him and shot him on the back and on the chest and on the back. And the police reports actually say that Juan Manuel Saldaña was actually shot and killed as he was coming down a stairway aiming a gun at police officers. During the same incident, other police officers at another end of the building, this is an apartment building, shot Oscar Peralta, and again, he was unarmed, and police officers planted a gun on him, claiming that he had also pointed the gun at them. The conviction of Oscar Peralta is actually being overturned at the request after he filed a writ of habeas corpus and with the approval, essentially, of the district attorney's office. And the district attorney's office in this case actually filed that writ or agreed on the writ itself in order to prevent his office from being forced to turn in evidence to the defense attorneys who had filed the writ of habeas corpus. We have filed a writ of lawsuit for violation of civil rights on the Juan Manuel Saldaña case. And we're in the process of preparing another lawsuit on behalf of Oscar Peralta. What we have is, again, the same officer not being involved, apparently, that is Rafael Perez, but actually turning in other police officers for what he calls a dirty shooting.
And in terms of the impact on the community, on the Latino and African American communities of Los Angeles, of this growing scandal, what has been the reaction within the community? And do you think that any of this would have come to light had it not been with the situation that developed with Rafael Perez?
It would not have come to light. Obviously, except for the fact that a police officer came forward, claims and complaints of this kind of conduct on the part of police officers, planting guns, unjustified shootings, in effect, murder, have been going on, have taken place for years, for decades. But the police department has turned a deaf ear to these claims and essentially... if one of the scandals comes to light, essentially dealing with them as an aberration, as an isolated incident. So clearly, it would not have taken place. I think one of the things that is disturbing about this, and it may be that the community, that we are jaded in this community with so much police misconduct over the years, is that we do not have the kind of outrage, the kind of community response that one would wish, given the gravity of the violation of human rights situations that have come to light as a result of Rafael Perez's revelations.
Sophia Saldana is with us as well, the mother of Juan Manuel Saldana, the only murder victim associated so far with the Rampart scandal. He was shot twice, once in the back, once in the chest. What are you calling for now, Mrs. Saldana?
I'm calling for justice. I want everybody at the police station on Rampart to pay for what they've done to my son. They don't have the right to kill my son the way they did.
What were you told originally happened to your son?
They don't say nothing to me. That day, they didn't call me. I found out about my son next morning when one of his friends called me from jail. And he told me there was a shooting in Chateau Place. And my son got shot. Then I went to the hospital, and they told me my son was dead on the arrival from the ambulance. So I went to the police Rampart station, and I asked him why they didn't call me. And they told me they don't have to call me because my son, he was older. And I told them he lived with me, and they said, we don't do nothing, so they don't have the right to call me. They don't say nothing, and I ask them, and they told me they shot him because my son had a gun, and I'm pointing on them, and that's why they killed him.
And how long was it before you actually found out what happened to your son? How much time passed, or did you have some indication beforehand, but no one would believe you?
Well, that night, I didn't know my son was shot, right? And we keep beeping, and he didn't answer to us. So my son keep calling to the hospitals, to the jails and everybody, and they don't say nothing. So we found out about him for his friend who was arrested that night, too. But the police never called me.
We're talking to Sofia Saldana, the mother of Juan Manuel Saldana, only murder victim so far associated with the Rampart scandal. Antonio Rodriguez, her lawyer, who has brought a suit and a federal civil rights lawsuit on behalf of the Saldana family. We're also joined by Jim Ritania, who is a 15-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department. In 1985, his brother killed after being hit in the head by an LAPD baton. He wrote a piece years ago in the Los Angeles Times, an op-ed piece, which began, "The phone never sounded as loud as it did that early Saturday morning. My father was on the phone. He said that my brother had been taken to the hospital after an incident with police officers. As a 14-year veteran of the Los Angeles Police Department, I never allowed my personal feelings to interfere with my job. My attitude toward the public was summed up in a 60s bumper sticker. If you don't like cops, the next time you need help, call a hippie. It was us against them. As a Mexican-American officer, I was a minority within a minority in a world only another cop could understand. I was teamed with officers of all races, but we had one thing in common, the badge. The morning that the phone call came was the beginning of my discovery of the dark side of that badge. Tell us what you learned, Jim Ritania."
Good morning. It's been a long time since that incident happened, and I've had a lot of chance to look back on that and have a lot of perspective on it. And I think the main thing that I realize is that within the department itself, there's decent officers that sometimes are tainted by the actions of a few, and I think that some of the problems that are created within that mix of officers has to do with the bureaucracy itself of the department. I think the department sometimes it's hard for them to look within themselves and honestly critique the things that they do that are wrong. I think it's also incumbent upon me to say that being a former officer, I understand both sides of the job and how difficult it is to sometimes not leave personal biases that you've grown up with coming forth into the job, which is also difficult in itself. But it's a thing that you look back on and you say, what could I have done different? What changes could I have done myself? And sometimes it's still hard to even answer those questions.
Well, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the situation with the L.A. Police Department as a whole, those of us across the country now over the last few years have heard about everything from the Rodney King situation to the screw-ups in the investigation of the O.J. Simpson case to the Tyesha Miller case and now to this Ramparts case. What has been going on with the L.A. Police Department? Why does it seem unable to sort of curb these internal problems and do something about its relationship to the community as a whole?
I think the agency or the department itself, it's so huge. I think changes come in little steps. I think little changes that do occur are actually on the outside should be viewed as big changes. The department as a whole, as we are as persons, are all resistant to change, and I think when they do occur, sometimes I think it takes, something that occurs that is a major incident, as a Rodney King or a Rampart scandal, to bubble the small things to the top that we can look as a society. We put ourselves together and we say, what can we do to improve the situation? I think over the years, I think it's just been bubbling, and the small things have added up to big things. There's a theory out there called broken windows, where if you let the little things go, the criminals know that maybe there's not a law enforcement is not taken serious in the community. I think within the department itself, it works the same way. If little things are let go, I think the officers themselves think that maybe they're not the department isn't taking this as serious. I think the officers in the street are really a reflection, I think, of the system within the department. So if we have anyone to blame, I don't think it's the officers themselves directly. I think it's what the department themselves has to take a critical look at itself and say, what have we done wrong? What can we do better? I think that should be a constant element of change within the department. But it's such a huge bureaucracy, it's hard for that to occur. But I think it needs to occur now.
Why did you quit?
I left the department basically because, being an officer, I got involved in the investigation. I saw what happened. I wasn't happy with some of the things that took place during the investigation.
Of your brother's death?
Yes, I did.
What exactly happened to him?
He was at his girlfriend's house. There was a dispute between me and his girlfriend. She had the officers arrive. To be fair to the officers, she told them there was a burglar at her house. To get the fast response, they arrived. My brother confronted the sergeant, who was backpedaling, fell down, dropped his flashlight. My brother stepped back, didn't want to engage him. He asked for a backup. Other officers arrived. They basically drew their weapons. The sergeant told them to holster the weapon. He was not armed. It depends on whose version you want to believe. But the next thing that occurred was officer moved towards him. He kicked him in the chest. Two different versions. My brother was hit the baton, bounced off my brother's shoulder, struck his head. Next version I heard was my brother, when I saw it to the hospital, I saw no bruises on my brother's shoulder. The next version was that he had ducked. Direct blow to the head, which totally was against LAPD policy. I think here again you have an issue where the department basically, I think, overzealously sided with the officer's version. I don't think it's the type of thing where they even know it's deliberate. I think it's really hard for officers to investigate themselves. But that's what occurred. He died a week later in the hospital. Basically, based on what I knew, I stayed on the department another year. It became increasingly difficult to perform my duties. I think the best way to sum it up was towards the end, I failed to search a suspect that was armed with a weapon and a shoulder holster. I was kind of leaning towards the other way of trying to be more community-minded. I didn't search him, but some officers came up. They began to search him. He went for his weapon and the shoulder holster, and an officer was almost shot. After that, I realized, of course, that I wasn't going to be able to do any good to the department or myself, and I left after that.
Antonio Rodriguez, we have only about 30 seconds left. Could you give us your viewpoint of why it's been so hard to reform the LAPD?
Well, we have a department that is resistant to change down to the core, with leadership that's old, and with a department essentially that over decades has ignored and refused to listen to the complaints of police misconduct of all types that have been described. And I believe that what's happening here is that we're having the chickens coming home to roost of essentially the values and ethics of the police department are so rotten to the core that what we're looking at is the manifestations of the tolerance of police violence, of police crimes, and under the present circumstances, then it's going to take a really reform down to the core.
On that note,
personnel.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Antonio Rodriguez, civil rights attorney, Jim Ritania, former officer with the LAPD, and Sofia Saldana, the mother of Juan Manuel Saldana, who died in police hands. That does it for the show. Thank you to OP, Heritage OP, who is with us in the studio, the musical group, Democracy Now!, produced by David Love and Karen Palmer, Errol Maitland, our director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Never talk to people about real ideas. Never try to inform people about what issues are at play.